want to turn to the voter ID law. It was in effect for this election. I think there were something fewer than 400 election identification certificates, the form of photo ID issued by the state, specifically for voting if people didn't have the other six approved forms. But it's also kind of hard to get a handle on what impact the law had on voters, in particular the 500,000 plus voters who were registered but don't have one of the forms of ID. Does somebody want to address like what impact that may or may not have had?
Well, I was trying to find some data on this question. I think voter ID is unconstitutional. I don't think you need an ID to vote. That's not where the right to vote comes from. But that's my only Democratic moment of the night, I think. But with that said, I think the data on it is, of course, somewhat inconclusive. 538, Nate Silver did a review of studies about voter ID laws in other states in 2012 and found that on average there was maybe about a 2% decrease in turnout after states passed voter ID laws, but that it varied a lot by state. GAO, the Government Accountability Office, that's right, did a sort of study of studies and found that in 10 studies with voter ID laws, 5 had no measurable effect, 4 decreased turnout marginally, 1 increased turnout marginally. So in a context like this, where statewide elections are being won by 20-point margins, I mean, it didn't sway the outcome of anything, I think. But with that said, I mean, I think that we don't need it. It's not stopping any election fraud. The idea of it stopping election fraud, I've always thought, is really silly. And we've seen kind of these scattered reports about individual voters who are thwarted by it and how the kind of nominal cost and money and time of getting an ID sounds pretty minimal to maybe most of us here, but it's actually pretty serious if you have to get, you know, a bus to the DPS to get an ID. So I don't think it was a major factor in the elections in the end, but I think it's an issue that is rightly controversial.
Let me disagree with Ms. Greeter on whether or not this is constitutional. I think it is constitutional. I think we're seeing that in the courts play out. I think the good news for us in this room is that we're going to have the courts make this determination for us. I mean, the legislature has acted. It has gone through the district court, now the appellate court, and ultimately will be at the Supreme Court. So this decision will be made and determined very shortly. I think we're going to see some answers from the Supremes. Now, I will say this. The people are behind this measure overwhelmingly. If you look at the statistics, most people are in favor of this. Now, in this room, perhaps not. But if you look at the overall statistics, you will find that most people do not find it an unreasonable measure to ask someone to present a photograph ID when they're going to cast the ballot. I mean, the franchise is one of our sacred rights as citizens. To ask someone to present identification to show that who you are does not seem unreasonable to the average nonpartisan person. So I'm not talking about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about going out to a group of 10 people at a UT football game and asking them, is it unfair to ask someone to do this? And I think 9 or 8 out of 10 of them, the statistic will show you, I think it's eminently reasonable. And
that's why the federal court said that Texas intentionally discriminated in this specific.
An appellate court said that,
yes.
Right? A district court did not. And I think we're going to see it at the Supreme Court level. They'll rule on this. Now, you and I can disagree all day long,
my problem, Jason, is you're conflating voter ID with Texas voter ID. This is the most restrictive voter ID bill in the country. If my driver's license says Harvey Initial J. Kronberg and my voter registration says Harvey J. J-A-Y Kronberg, I can only cast a provisional vote and then come back within five days to get my vote validated. Now, that is absolutely Supreme Court has surprised me in numerous fashions in what their interpretation of the Constitution is. So maybe it is constitutional. But don't conflate the Texas voter ID law with Judge Posner up in Indiana said it was the worst decision he ever made, but he also wrote that no harm had yet been demonstrated. Well, if you lose 2% of your voters, that's a harm that's been demonstrated.
But we don't know if we have lost 2% of our voters. So look, every reasonable Republican, I should say, including this one, would make the necessary changes to ameliorate the concerns that you have.
Yeah.
So if we have four identification badges that work, a driver's license, a passport, a military ID, or whatever, and that's insufficient for the purposes that you and I might discuss, you know, let's talk about how we expand that to make it more reasonable and ameliorate those concerns that we have in the rural areas, right? But fundamentally, asking someone to present proof that they are who they are is not unreasonable.
To me, this is talking about it from the wrong, totally wrong perspective in the first place. As someone who had to go through a 4.5-month challenge of my election, where out of almost 52,000 votes cast, ultimately I won by only four, and with the examination of those votes, the subpoenas, everything that went on, there was no voter fraud. There was no voter fraud, and that's still not an issue. Forrest, you were talking about Texas being at the bottom in terms of voter turnout. Why in the hell are we talking about suppressing votes or coming up with things that make it more difficult when we need to get more people out to the polls? And it seems that having a voter ID law that is not necessary. That, sure, you know, you ask somebody, does it sound reasonable to show a photo? Sure, that sounds reasonable. It's not necessary, though. And it's ironic that my voter registration card is not even necessary for me to vote. I have to have other forms of identification, not my voter registration card, to vote. I just believe that the discussion we're having is one that has been fabricated out of a non-necessity, when indeed our discussion and our different way we might approach it as Republicans and Democrats or independents or whatever is, what do we do to get more people to the polls? The integrity of the vote is there, as far as I'm concerned. It's what do we do to get more people there? And so until we have that discussion, I don't see this as being anything other than a political move to actually discourage voting.
Let me respectfully disagree with my good friend, Representative Howard, who's here. Look, I served on the Dallas County Citizens Elections Advisory Committee for several years before I became an elected representative, and I can tell you, we had volumes of instances where there was voter fraud. It does indeed exist. Now, does it exist at the level of situations where someone is saying they are who they are, the ones that you're referring to? We don't see many instances of that. We see more voter harvesting than any other issue. I'll concede that this measure doesn't address that. But to ask for integrity at the ballot box is not an unreasonable proposition, right? And to go back to your point, and I can take the countervailing argument regarding your position, which is we only do this in order to suppress Hispanic and African-American votes. And I can tell you, this Republican is Hispanic. My grandmother and her family and all my family vote in ways that you might deem to be were somehow being suppressed. But I can tell you that's not the objective of these measures. We are truly seeking out integrity at the ballot box. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in one of her pronouncements, said, in Texas particularly, there are 500,000 situations where this would result in someone not being able to cast a ballot. And yet we've gone through three election cycles now where this measure was on the books, and we've had only a pittance of instances where someone claimed they were unable to cast a ballot because of the restrictive nature of the measure.
Is it the dog that didn't bark? Is it the dog that didn't bark? Is the presumption on the citizen to prove that they're a citizen and entitled to vote, or is it the presumption that the state has the right to challenge you, every person that walks up to a voting box, to prove that they're? I would argue the former, that the presumption is with the citizen, not with the state.
All right. Well,
I have no opinion on that.
Oh, it's a good discussion.
There's one more quick ironic thing that should be noted. The Democrats, we've been dumping on Republicans on this. Democrats had a really good, relatively speaking, voter ID bill that they chubbed to death in the House.
prior to the one that ultimately did pass. The one that Todd Smith authored was actually in many ways a model voter ID bill, if you're going to have one. And for whatever, well, I know what the reasons were, but they ended up using local and consent calendar to kill 3 or 4 weeks of the session, and the bill was actually a pretty damn good bill. Lots of options for proving that you were a citizen.
Well, speaking of Democratic strategies at the legislature, I think we could maybe turn a little bit away from the election and look forward to the session, which is, does anybody know how many days away?
I think
60-ish, okay. So what dynamic do we expect? I mean, I think one of the themes or one of the questions is going to be how the Senate is going to act now that we have a new lieutenant governor in place and a relatively new new set of senators, Republicans of the kind of Tea Party bent. Does anybody want to speak to the expected dynamics both within the Senate and how the Senate and the House may play off each other on the level of politics, but also policy, what bills we can look forward to and how they might move?
Well, Dan Patrick is in a really comfortable position, so I'm sure Erica will want to talk about this. She had a great piece about Dan Patrick. Spent some time with him talking about his legislative priorities. But if you do believe that he is looking to run for governor or another office someday, he's in a position with his Senate that he can file or pass bills that are very popular with the conservative primary voters and have them either killed by Strauss or vetoed by Abbott, making them unpopular in the process and establishing him as a kind of warrior figure for priorities that are not getting addressed at the legislature. I think it's going to be a really interesting dynamic. I mean, after this long, expensive election cycle, we still don't know very much about what kind of governor Greg Abbott is going to be, whether he's going to be a strong or weak figure with the legislature, or even what his policy priorities are. He's talked to editorial boards and in some other ways about the need to increase state investment in infrastructure and education and these other priorities, and I think it's just going to be very difficult for him to do that. He's not going to have a lot of space to maneuver, I think.
Arby?
I have a few opinions. First of all, let's simply say that Patrick, to a certain degree, is in a box. The biggest winner out of this election was the Republican primary voter. Up until now, the only group that Patrick has ever had to satisfy has been Republican primary voters. Now he has 31 senators. He's not a senator anymore. He doesn't even get to caucus with them unless they invite him into the back room to caucus with him. Right now, everybody is making nice and reaching out, and the Republicans are holding fundraisers. Even the ones that don't like him or don't trust him are holding fundraisers. And let's just look at it. One quick thing. He can be either the impeccable showman or the impeccable mechanic. And he really, I say that as seriously as I can. He can build coalitions and he can make the place work. But he also has to play to a second constituency, which is a talk radio audience. And I think that many of you may not know that David Dewhurst was taken out of the chair twice during the time that Dan Patrick was a state senator. The real policy is not made on the floor of the Senate. Whoever's in the chair is presiding. The real policy is in the Betty King room when the Senate caucuses or the Republicans and the Democrats caucus. And there are, by my count, three factions of Republicans right now that he has to deal with before he even gets to the Democrats. The first are some of the most conservative freshmen and sophomores who are the most ideological. The second group are the senior members, the Seligers and the L-types and the Craig Esteses, who know that they are really miniature governors. And the third group is, and I say this mostly just to tick off Tim Dunn, who is Michael Quinn Sullivan's benefactor, for those of you who don't know. The Republican House members that are senators come from the House that Strauss built. They're not housebroken, they're Strauss-broken. They've seen process work. They know how to exercise power. They have respect for procedure and And I don't know which way they're going to go. When you look at them, they all are very responsive to big corporate interests, and that's not said negatively. That's part of the party culture. But the Tea Party is anti-institutional. It is anti-corporate. It's anti-party. And I think that Patrick just managing his Republicans, not in the first 60 days, but when we start getting into serious stuff, is going to have a whole series of issues. And the Democrats may well in the Senate just sit back and say, it's your show. Let's see what you guys do.
I think something very telling happened today, in the last 2 days actually, with the development of one of the preeminent Tea Partier House members and the leader of the House members who are consider themselves Tea Partiers, decided today and last night at a Tea Party meeting in North Texas to announce his support in fealty to Speaker Strauss. Now, that is a very important move, right? So this is Giovanni Caprioloni we're referring to. Now, Giovanni came in as a firebrand. He came in as a person who was dedicated to this movement. He is supported by Michael Quinn Sullivan and Power Texans, Tim Dunn, the whole group. Loved and revered by the Tea Party. And here it is 2 years later, he is supporting the speaker. Why? Well, he's from South Lake. He believes strongly in transportation issues, and so he's going to be focusing on that this session. And he is a thoughtful, thinking, respected member of the House. And so I think you're seeing an evolution there. Now, I can tell you from having discussions with him and other members of that cadre, he's not the first. On day one of the House, in January 13th, there's going to be a vote. Now, historically, what's happened is the Tea Party has rabble-roused and said they're going to run and they're going to challenge the Speaker, and you know we're going to have this vote. And then right before they bail. They bail, and we do it by unanimous consent, and then we all support the Speaker. Well, this year, what we've been promised by certain members of our House, good friends of mine, is that there will indeed be a vote. There is going to be a vote on day one. And people think, well, what's the status of the speaker's race, Jason? And they ask me that. And I tell you, there is no speaker's race. This race is over. It is a fait accompli. Speaker Strauss will prevail, and he will prevail by overwhelming numbers. In fact, I love Scottie Turner. He's a very good man, a godly man, a person who I have great respect for, and he has a great future in the party. But I would be surprised if he exceeds 15 votes on that night. And that's something that I think is very telling about the tenor of the House. Now, we still have a Senate that will be, I think, the most conservative Senate that we've seen in a generation. And, you know, I know that that Lieutenant Governor Patrick will be focused on advancing some of those conservative agenda items. But in the end, we do have this conflict between the tenor of the Senate and the tenor of the House. And we're going to have to find a reasonable middle ground to get us to advance the agenda of Texas. And conflict is good. We're going to have some of that. I think the session goes longer because of that conflict. But I think ultimately it's a good thing for the people of Texas to have these kinds of debates.
Representative Howard, how about being a Democrat in the legislature, and obviously in the House in particular? There's not a supermajority this time, but the numbers are break obviously very heavily in favor of the Republicans. Going into the session, what's your agenda? What's your approach and that of your colleagues as well?
Well, I've actually served where we had a 76-74 House, and I've served where we had a 101-49 House, and so I've seen kind of both ends of the spectrum there. And last time, when we got up to having 55 Democrats, what I found was that was enough of a critical mass, if you will, to actually have some opportunities for leveraging some things. Now, Jason was talking about, I think it was you a while ago, talking about the makeup. I can't remember now exactly. But anyway, a lot of people say that our House is basically three parties. You probably say this, Harvey. You know, we've got the Tea Party Republicans, we've got the so-called mainstream Republicans, and we've got the Democrats, and we're kind of divided. 50-50-50 there for our 150 House members. So when you have over 50 Democrats, you at least have the opportunity to build some coalitions to actually have some effective change occur, progress, in my opinion, moving forward. And I think that was evidenced last session in particular, my first session to serve on appropriations, when we were able to build some coalitions among Democrats and Republicans that got more funding continually added into public education than was originally offered to us, if you will. So certainly when you get to the summer and the special sessions, all of that fell apart. And you see the issue with having so few Democrats. But under the leadership of Speaker Strauss, I think that we're going to be focused from what I know what the Speaker is pushing for. We're going to be focused on continuing to try to work on those issues that we can find some agreement for working towards solutions, such as with infrastructure, such as with even if we're not going to look at the whole school finance issue, we're going to be focused on some of the things that we can do until we get to the point of actually really fully addressing school finance. We've already got an informal working group of some Republicans and Democrats that are meeting right now representing different types of school districts throughout the state, trying to come up with what are some of the things that we can do to get some more funding into all of the schools in our state, short of actually redoing the whole school finance system. So my point being that I think even with 52, that though it's going to be difficult, and we're going to have a hard time getting some of our agenda through there, that it at least gives us enough members, if we stick together and work with some coalitions of Republicans who feel similarly to us on finding some kind of workable solutions and that awful C word of compromise, but that some are willing to do, that we can actually affect change.
We'll get to your questions in just a minute or two, but I wanted to hear if anybody else wanted to address what other issues we should be watching going into the session. You know, I'm thinking women's health. I'm thinking, you know, open carry. Has Governor Abbott said he would sign a bill if it got in front of him for open carry? If y'all want to.
I'll jump in on that and kind of related to the previous question. I think it's going to be a really probably quite boring session. In other words, probably a pretty good session for the state, but bad for journalists. I think everyone's tired of social issues, as far as I can tell. After last summer, I think the Republicans felt like they got a pretty big win on social issues, and there's not much energy for doing that again. Open carry means there's a guns issue coming through, and it sounds like really inflammatory, but 47 states have open carry already. It doesn't really cause people to carry guns in public. It's just kind of it'll get through, it'll pass, and that's like the guns lobby's happy. There's a lot of focus, I think, on the Tea Party side about doing transportation funding, which is actually a really great priority to do. I mean, we have been neglecting this for too long. We passed Prop 1 statewide this year, which is part of the solution but not the entire solution. So if the Tea Party is motivated to really tackle that, that's great. And then beyond that, the state's going to be awash in money, so it's a chance to do things like road funding without cutting necessarily into school funding. So I guess the thing that I'm most worried about looking at the ledge is that there's a lot of people in the ledge, mostly on the Republican side, frankly, who are not really good at budget math, who can't really count or forecast and that kind of thing. Capriglione counting the speaker votes was, math coming to the fore. I was happy to see that. But with someone like, Senator Patrick, I don't think he wants to really gut government the way he's perceived to want to. I think he has plans that don't quite add up. Like, he wants to put more money into schools, more money into roads, but also cut property taxes, which are locally controlled. We'll see how that plays out, but I think there's enough kind of salutary factors going into this that will do kind of core function of the government and not much more.
You said he does want to cut property taxes or does not?
He wants to lower property taxes. He does not necessarily want to raise sales taxes to offset it, but he wants to somehow constrain the growth of property taxes or lower them altogether. I had asked him when I was talking to him for this profile, are you proposing to cut any area of state spending to kind of offset that? And he said, well, Erica, we don't have a statewide property tax, so it's not really our concern. I was like, great, thanks. But If he cuts, if the state constrains property taxes, of course that means local governments have to either stretch the money they have further, which they don't seem inclined to do. We've seen this explosion in local debt in the past 10, 20 years, or some kind of offsetting state cuts. But I think that's all sort of mathematically far-fetched to me, but it's also not really on the horizon yet. So we'll see, I think, what kind of proposal he comes up with or the Senate comes up with, and then they'll have to, of course, figure out if they can actually make it work.
And I think that's actually going to be the biggest debate we're going to have, is what to do with the budget, obviously. And this the terminology that you used, Erica, of a wash, I think, in money. And the whole narrative that we have now that we're going to have all this surplus money, you know, we have many, many holes in our current budget. And some of them are dependent upon surplus. The 2006 property tax swap was never a full swap. It was always dependent on surplus to cover a huge chunk of change there. And we never fully fund Medicaid. We're going to have to pay for that when we come back. And you know, we've continually discussed, Jason, the speaker's directive that we work toward diminishing the number of dollars that we're using that were dedicated for another purpose, and we're holding them back from appropriating them in order to certify the budget. We've got $4 billion of those right there. So this whole concept of having extra money, and we had a bill filed that's going to eliminate the franchise tax totally. You know, I mean, my big concern now is how we're going to have a rational, reasonable discussion about the budget with a lot of the new folks that are coming in to the session who think we have a huge surplus. And indeed, we have a surplus in terms of what wasn't appropriated, but we have huge holes in the current budget that have to be plugged somehow. So, and there's a lot of people that don't know math over there. So it's going to be a hard job, I think, to get that down right.
I heard that, you know, Senator Nelson, Jane Nelson, is the chair of Senate Finance, and so she's had people kind of come in saying, we need to cut the budget, and she's done this before. She's worked on the budget before, so she's like, okay, what do you want to cut? Because the budget's really lean statewide. There's not a lot to cut. If you want to spend more on anything right now, with the pie being the size it is, you have to cut public schools for the most part. So I think she's just been saying, okay, like, why don't you go look at the budget and tell me what we're going to cut, and, like, come back and we'll talk about it. And so they'll figure that out pretty fast when they have to do the spreadsheets. One would think.
I read Erica Greeter every morning when she has a piece. I think she's one of the smartest writers out there. I'm surprised by her position on this, that it's going to be an uneventful session. I can tell you, my admonition would be get your popcorn ready, because I think this is going to be a lot of fun. I think we're going to have three parties, as you point out, and I think there's going to be wrestling matches between all three constituencies at any moment in time. While I recognize that Patrick, I think, is going to focus on governing and doing a good job. I mean, he wants a second act, right? I mean, he's not going to do the things that some people suggest he's going to do. He's going to be a strong, a hands-on leader, but we are going to have conflict. You're going to see bills that emerge. I mean, take a look at the 171 that were filed in the last 2 days. We're going to have bills that emerge that we are going to fight over. And I think that's going to evidence itself in the early days. I think there is this schism between the far right and the common sense conservatives, and I think that plays out. I think it's going to be very interesting, more attuned to the 82nd legislature than the 83rd. Now, this instance, we do have more resources to be able to provide for Texas, but that doesn't eliminate these sort of fundamental issues that we fight about, and make no mistake, Republicans can always find social issues to get behind. So I think we're going to have some real debate. And again, I think this is healthy. You know, I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. I think it's healthy to have these discussions. My only concern, and this is one that I've shared with Representative Howard before, is that, you know, we have 140 days to advance the agenda of Texas. We've got a public school finance system that the Supreme Court has said is unconstitutional. We've got an underfunded transportation system that we have to deal with. We've got an infrastructure problem with our electricity grids that needs to be addressed. And we've got 140 days constitutionally for the biennium to fix it. And that doesn't even include the debate we're going to have on the budget that we have. And so we've got a very limited period of time to do real work for the people. And I just get troubled anytime we get bogged down in those issues that seem to be more divisive than the ones that impact the people in this room. So I know that Representative Howard shares my focus and concern on the issues that are really impactful for Texans. She's common sense. I'm common sense. We happen to be on different parties, but I'm hopeful that in the end, the common sense Texans move forward and win this battle rather than the ideologues on either side of the party.
Harvey, last word here, okay. Then we'll take some questions.
Two quick things. One is that I'm always looking for whatever's going to destabilize the process because it's good for business. And we have plenty of things that are going to destabilize the process. First of all, the Speaker and the Lieutenant Governor. The Lieutenant Governor was very active in Strauss's first term trying to get him beat, and very active and a little less active in his second term trying to get him beat. He is of the same cloth as Tim Dunn, who lives to beat Strauss. So that's one problem. The second problem is that he, and I use this word advisedly, betrayed his fellow Republicans on the final budget vote in this last session. He was on Senate Finance. He was chairman of a major committee, Public Education. He voted for virtually every amendment. He passed the bill out of committee and raised no objections during the course of that process. And then on the day of the vote, we knew there were four or five Tea Party Republicans that were going to vote no. He was a question mark, and he ended up surprising everybody, voting no. Now he's got this whole crew of Republicans that he's got to work with that walked the plank to vote for that budget that he wouldn't vote for. So his first order of business, not impossible, but his first order of business is to establish that that he is an honest negotiating partner, both inside his own caucus, with the other senators and with the other two of the big three, the Speaker and the governor.